Okay. My name is Jacqueline Claros Benitez, and I'm at the Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean House within Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. I'm doing a Zoom interview with Wendy Kendrick, who is in Gahanna, Ohio. Today is October 30th, 2022, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hi, Wendy. Thank you so much for joining me today. We appreciate it. First, I'd like to learn a little about your childhood. Can you please state when and where you were born?
When and where? I was born January 15th, 1955 in Georgetown, Kentucky. I am one of five children, and I am the second oldest in my family.
Thank you. Can you tell me the names of your parents, please?
Yes. My dad, Theodore Thompson. My mom, Catherine Thompson. And then, that's all. I'll stop right there.
Okay. What was it
like? Mom remarried down the road, so.
What was it like growing up in Gahanna, Ohio, and your other hometown that you emailed me about, Georgetown, Kentucky?
Okay, so I was born in Kentucky, but raised, my parents moved when I was young. We moved to Cincinnati. And so school for me, I started in Cincinnati, actually started kindergarten when I was four at Rockdale Temple in Cincinnati. And we stayed there until I was in third grade, and then we moved to Dayton, Ohio. And that's where I spent the rest of my years until high school graduation.
Got it. Is there a particular reason why you kept moving as a family?
I was wondering when I thought about that. It's something that I realized when I was like in my teen years. And I'm imagining, you go by Jackie?
Yes.
Okay. I'm imagining, Jackie, it was because of probably jobs and housing. Because, you know, if you think about it, I was born in the mid-50s. And so if you look at what was going on in the U.S. in terms of the racial climate, housing was a major concern, not only for African Americans, but for other people as well, particularly those coming to the U.S., immigrants, but for African Americans particularly, you know, you had redlining was going on. You know, it was just a lot of things that were happening. And so, yeah, I have wondered about that, because when I look at my younger siblings, they grew up in one house, you know, from a young age all the way through high school, whereas my early years, we were kind of moving around some. So I'm not really sure. And unfortunately, my parents both are deceased, so I can't ask them those questions now. But I do think about that sometimes and wonder. But I imagine it was definitely for work and just trying to provide the best for the family.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that with me. Uh-huh. What is your happiest childhood memory?
Happiest? Let's see. Lots of happy memories. I can remember, I was a zoo fan. I love the zoo.
Oh, wow.
And my mom had, one of her friends, dear friends, they did not have any children. And so Miss Eloise would come and get me sometimes and take me on outings. And I remember this particular outfit I had on. Oh my goodness. I had to have been probably 3 or 4. And I just remember getting dressed up in this. It was called a skirt because it had the it was a little plaid skirt. It was a sailor top, white with the little plaid trim. I was cute. And I had that on and we went to the zoo, and it just was so special. That was probably one of the earliest memories I have of going somewhere with someone other than my family. And so it made me feel so special. Yeah, the zoo was a big to do for me.
Got it. Were you passionate about art from a young age?
I was. I think my earliest memory I remember, and it's still like that for me today. Crayons, the smell of crayons, a new box of crayons. I didn't do it this year. I haven't done it the last 2 years, but typically every school year, even though I'm not always in a school, I buy a new box of crayons because it's something about the smell of the crayons. And we're frozen for a second. Okay. Are we unfrozen?
I think now we're okay.
Okay. I'm not sure what that is. I don't know if it's me on my end or what. But anyhow, definitely passionate. Always was drawing. I can remember one of the stories my mom used to tell all the time was about me when she first realized I could draw. And I had to have been, I don't know, 3, 4. And I came in the kitchen. She was cooking, and I came in the kitchen to show her this picture. It's the squirrel story. Okay, bear with me, Jackie. And so it was a picture of a squirrel. And so I was telling her, you know, I told my mom, I was like excited. I drew this picture of a squirrel. And my mother said, no, Wendy, you didn't draw that. You traced it. And I was, you know, I knew to be respectful, but I was trying to tell her, no, I drew it. And she, you know, as the story goes, I kept insisting that I drew it. And she just finally said, okay, show me where you, you know, where's the picture that you looked at if you drew it. So it was in a coloring book. And she took the paper and placed it on top of the picture. And she said it didn't fit. And that was when she realized I had actually drawn it and not traced it. So, oh, wow. Yeah.
That reminds me of a younger sister because she can draw better than me. She's only 13. Her artwork is really impressive. So I always tell her to always follow her passion no matter what anyone tells her, because I know that there's like this like negative association correlated to the arts as opposed to like fields like STEM. Yeah.
Know what that's about, but yes.
Yeah.
We got to combat that.
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents always supportive of your art passion?
No. So think about when I was, you know, a kid. So yes, they were not. They didn't get me. They didn't understand me for a long time because, you know, even now when I think about it, it probably did sound crazy because as a kid, I was interested. I didn't know exactly how I was going to maneuver this journey, but I knew there was something about the arts that I really, really loved. And I wasn't, it wasn't dance, it wasn't performance or anything like that. I did write a little bit as I got probably in elementary. I started writing some. But I can remember going in one day, I had seen this, you know, early morning, some kind of little documentary on the TV. And it was on glass blowing. And it just did something for me. And I remember going in and telling my mom, I know what I want to be. I want to be a glass blower. And she looked at me as if I was an alien that just landed on Earth, you know, and she had just witnessed the landing. And, you know, and I didn't understand why she wasn't excited because I was so excited to see this guy blowing this glass. And, you know, it just, this form just appeared in front of my eyes. And I was like, this is so amazing. And, you know, so they tried to drive home to me to go to school and major in business or education to get a good job because that's where they had ended up. And so my parents had difficulty initially after college. They went to college, both of them, they went to Kentucky State. And my parents, when I was an infant, so I had a brother a couple years ahead of me. And so they left us with my grandmother, our grandmother in Kentucky, to go for interview. They had interview for teaching positions in Michigan. And so they went, drove all the way to Michigan from Kentucky. And when they got there, they were told the guy that spoke with them on the phone who had, you know, verbally hired them and they had the paperwork and all that. He said that he could not hire them because on the phone they didn't sound black. And so, yes. So they didn't get the position. Actually, it made it into Jet Magazine way back. That it was a little tiny article about them. But, you know, so based upon that, when I was coming along, you know, that's some of the things that my parents went through. So they tried to guide us according to what they knew at that time and what they felt was best for us. And they surely did not know any artist. So, you know, I guess it did seem really foreign. You know, that kind of understanding I have at this point in my life. But when I was younger, I didn't have that understanding. And I didn't understand why they responded to the things that interested me the way they did. So, yes.
Right. You briefly mentioned your grandmother. And I remember from a documentary my professor shared with me, you had mentioned that coaching reminded you of her. How was she a primary figure in your passion for art?
My grandmother is my mom's mother. And we called her Big Mama. And so she was a seamstress, and she sold for people in town. She was an excellent cook. My mom was one of three girls in her family. And so my mother was the youngest, and her other two sisters had gone to college, but they did not stay. They went for the first year, and then they said it wasn't for them, and they came back home. And so we would go down to Kentucky, to Georgetown, to spend the summers. And when we went, I never knew where my siblings were because I didn't really care, because I just stuck with my grandmother. I loved everything that she did. I loved to sit at her feet when she would sew on that old sewing machine. And all these scraps would fall to the floor, and she would take those, and I had Barbies back then. And so she would make these clothes for my Barbie dolls, and they were the best. I mean, it would be a hat. You know, it might have been a tweed fabric because she was sewing for an adult. And so she would take those scraps, and without any pattern, I don't know how she did it, but she would make the best Barbie clothes ever. I mean, better than anything that you would find in the store. And so she did that. She taught me some forms of macrame. It was actually a bag. It was like a drawstring bag, and it was macrame. She didn't call it macrame, but she taught me how to do it. And back in those days too, everything in my grandmother's house was, I don't know about your grandmother's house or other people's homes, but back then everything in the kitchen and the house was decorated. You know, it was crocheted. The toilet paper had a crochet cover. The cookie jar had a cover on it. All these kinds of things I saw created in that environment, and I just loved it. I still have a cookie jar cover that my grandmother created, and it had to have been made in the 60s. It was made out of a cotton stocking, if you can imagine. So it's, you know, it's kind of seen better days, but I keep it because it's a reminder of her. So she always felt she got me. She understood me. And she just fed that creative part of me. My dad was very creative as well, and he fed it too. I always say my grandmother, but my dad was very creative. My dad could make anything. My dad made furniture. I mean, I remember him making a coffee table when I was probably about 4 or 5. I saw him he made a lamp. I mean, whatever he thought of, he could make. Bookcases, whatever. You know, artwork. I saw him one day just pick up a piece of black construction paper, some black, white, and orange construction paper, and a razor blade, and cut this silhouette out, glue it down to the white paper. He added this orange piece around the neck. And I was like, whoa. And he framed, you know, put it in a frame, and it hung in our house. And so he did feed into me a lot. And it's interesting because I was the only one that he fed that stuff to. You know, my other siblings, they got other things from him, but he was the one that fed me creatively between the two parents. My mom was a storyteller. Right. So she loved storytelling, but yes. But my grandmother, yeah, I always felt like she got me. She really did.
Got it. I'm so happy to hear that you're able to receive support from a few family members. Did you feel supported by your teachers in elementary school and middle school in regards to your art passion?
Elementary, yeah, art was different back then. You know, art was on a cart when you had it. I don't remember it until I got I got into fourth grade. And fourth grade was definitely art on a cart. Prior to that, we probably had some form, but there was no specific art class. And my art teacher in the fourth grade, we were living in Dayton then, her name was Mrs. McGee. And she also happened to be a Black woman, which I thought was like, whoa. Wow. Because we didn't have a lot of Black teachers. Right. Okay. And I thought she was cool too, because she was very striking. She was dark complected, but she had this shock of almost white hair, a streak of it in her hair. And I thought that was pretty cool because I had never seen that. But she actually lived in Cincinnati and she commuted to Dayton to teach. And so what stood out for me was when she taught us how to make these paper mache puppets from a light bulb. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is like the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
So that was the first art teacher I can recall having, was fourth grade. And then high school, my teacher in high school, Anna Workmeister, bless her soul. She was extremely supportive. We did not have, at that point, we lived in Dayton and we lived outside the city limits in what's called Jefferson Township. And it was a farming community. It was actually a German community. And eventually Black families start moving in. And then the school system changed in terms of the diversity changed as time went on. But Mrs. Workmeister, when I got to high school, she realized how much art meant to me and how passionate I was. And back in those days, art was a class. It was like two rooms we had, small rooms. One where tables, everybody sat, and then there was a small back room that housed a kiln. And the kids in my class, unfortunately, they just came in the class because they thought it was an easy A. But that's not why I was there. So here I am trying to create all these things. So eventually she let me pretty much do just kind of like independent study. You know, the whole time I took art in high school, because she would allow me to bring my materials in from home. I would lug in, you know, chicken wire. I remember creating this huge giraffe out of chicken wire. And she allowed me to do it in the back room, away from all the other stuff that was going on in the classroom. And she eventually, it was about my senior year, she connected me to a place that was called the Living Arts Center. It was in Dayton, Ohio proper. And she told me about it. However, you had to be a city of Dayton resident, and we lived outside the city. But somehow she contacted the center and she told me to fill out the application, and I was able to attend. And so by going there, that's where I first met the first living artist. I was a high school senior. His name is Bing Davis. He still lives in Dayton. He was very, very supportive, became someone who encouraged me almost all the way through college, actually, and still to this day. So yeah, she was very supportive, and I have tried to find her and have been unable to. Hold on.
Okay. Sorry.
No worries.
I was trying.
Whew. Okay.
Thank you so much for sharing that with me. It makes me really happy to hear that you had a lot of support in high school. Now transitioning to high school and college, what high school did you attend and where was it located?
You were freezing up.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we'll be, it's okay, no worries. We'll be transitioning to high school and college. May you please state what high school you attended and where it was located?
Okay, I attended Jefferson Township High School, located in Jefferson Township, a suburb of Dayton, Ohio.
Got it. Thank you. Did you have any high school friends who shared your art passion, and do you still keep in touch with them?
There were, I would say not as serious as I was.
Okay.
There were a couple guys in my art class that liked to draw. Okay. And then there was a friend I had in middle school, who was had a passion for dance. And actually, she went on and made a career of it. And her name was Donna Wood. She went on to dance with Alvin Ailey. I know she was a lead dancer. She really was really went for it. But she was, you know, she was as passionate about dance as I was about the visual arts. And, but when we got to high school, she went to another high school. She switched to another high school. And so, no, there really wasn't, you know, there was, like I said, a couple of guys that liked to draw.
Right.
But for me, it was something much deeper. It was hard for me to explain, but it meant a lot more to me than what it did to other classmates.
Right. It's really impressive that you continued on with that passion despite being the only one. Now, transitioning to college, who or what influenced you to apply to college?
Okay, in our family, education was very important. And even with my parents were like the first generation on both sides to go to college. But even with that, my grandmother, my great-grandmother on my mom's side were very, very passionate readers. My great-grandmother lost her sight, probably start losing it maybe when I was in middle school. So by the time I was in high school, she had completely lost her sight. She had cataracts, and she was afraid. She had never been hospitalized, and she was afraid to have the surgery. So she didn't, you know, get it taken care of. So she ended up losing her sight, but she loved to be read to. And so with that foundation, my mom was an avid reader. She would take us, our trips on Friday evening, our big trip as a family of five, was going to the library. That was our treat after we got our chores done. And so that kind of foundation was laid. My mom and dad both went to Kentucky State, and there was no question about it. We all knew we were going to college. That was a given. However, my parents wanted me to go to Kentucky State. And that was a point of contention. That was my first time I rebelled against my parents. Yeah, I came up in a real strict household, you know, and I look at it now and I know my parents were doing what they thought was best for us, to keep us safe and to provide and take care of us and all that, which I'm thankful for. But I was really wanting to get out.
Yes.
And just, you know, I just wanted to get out and get away. And I felt like if I had gone to Kentucky State, that was too close to Ohio. And I had visions of my parents popping up on the weekends unannounced. And I was like, no, I don't want, you know, I felt like, and it probably wouldn't have been that way. In hindsight, I see it differently now as I've gotten older in terms of what they probably were trying to do for me. But I didn't understand it, and I didn't feel like it was communicated real well. So I imagine they were trying to protect me based upon their experiences. But when it came to college, my brother went to Dartmouth. And so that's how I knew about Dartmouth. But that was not where I wanted to go. I really was interested in the sister schools. I was interested in either going to Wellesley or Smith or Radcliffe. But yes, so education was a definite in our house.
Right. Got it. Thank you. I can somewhat relate. My parents wanted me, so I'm from New York City, the Bronx, mm-hmm. and my parents wanted me to stay within New York City. And I remember telling them that I had gotten into Dartmouth. And one of the first things my dad said was, oh, so you just want to leave us. And that really, yeah, it really struck me. It made it really difficult. Because I'm a very family-oriented person. I am the eldest in my immediate family. I'm the first to go to college, first gen low income. So there's a lot of pressures.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't, you know, it didn't, that didn't go well, I'll say.
Right. Yeah.
So for me, it actually resulted in me becoming estranged from my family. It was that serious. Yeah. Oh yeah, it was. So the whole time I was in Dartmouth, I was just there. You know, my dad was through with me. And so he just, you know, because it was so far away for one, I'm sure they were trying to figure out how are they going to pay for this. Mm-hmm. And so my brother had gone, he was, by the time I got to campus, my brother was a senior. And you know, and there were three more kids coming behind me. Yeah. And I just couldn't do it. I just could not do it. I just had to go my own, you know, my own path. I had to do that. So, I had to pay the consequences on that one. But, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the end, it seems like it was all worth it.
Yes. Yes, I think it was. I think it was. Yeah.
You mentioned that you wanted to go to the sister colleges. What caused you to decide to ultimately attend Dartmouth instead?
Financial aid.
Financial aid.
Yes. I mean, I'm just saying it's real. You know, because when at the end of the day, Dartmouth was the only school that was really offering me enough to really come. And so that was the bottom line. You know, because like I said, my parents were trying to figure out how's this going to work and all this. I mean, they were there and took me to the interviews when I had to go interview and all that stuff. You know, they did all of that, but I think they thought I was going to change my mind, you know, but I didn't. But that was it. The financial package made it such that, yes, I could come.
Yeah, I understand. How did your freshman fall at Dartmouth go? Your first term at Dartmouth?
Well, as I said, I was estranged from my family. So it was just, you know, and I was a really, what I didn't say, I was a shy kid. I was a really extremely shy kid. And so growing up where I grew up in Jefferson Township, it was a real close-knit Black community. And everybody knew each other. To this day, I still go to my class reunions. And it's like one of these communities, kind of unique. But in the sense that if you lived in the township, doesn't matter if you might have graduated 20 years after me. But if you lived in the township, it's like, it's all like an unspoken code. You know, it's like township. Some people even say township for life. So it's just a close-knit community because mostly coming up, almost everyone on my street in my neighborhood had the same number of kids. So you had siblings, you know, you were in each other's families, had siblings, and everybody was in each other's class. You knew everybody. It was just really close knit. I was in a real sheltered environment. My dad was really, like I said, it was strict in our household. They didn't play. And so, you know, even when I wanted to work, my dad told me I didn't need to, he would take care of me. So that was in high school when I wanted to get a job. He's like, oh, you don't need to do that. So I was really sheltered. I was sheltered and I was very shy. So when I came to school and I had rebelled by saying, this is where I'm going and bye. It was kind of difficult for me, but it wasn't as it wasn't as difficult probably as it could have been, because I started meeting people. And then when I started meeting people, plus before that, even before fall, I came in the bridge program. So they had the bridge program that summer before matriculating in the fall. And so that gave me a head start on friendships. And there was a small group of us in the bridge program. And so we were really close because we were up there for the summer, on campus for the summer. And we took, what did we take? We took math. We were able to take math and I don't know, if I forgot what the other class was. That's terrible. But anyhow, we were able to get two classes out the way. It might have been a language arts or something, you know, English or something. But yes, we just stuck together. And so when we came back to campus in the fall, unlike the other students arriving, unless they came from the same school, we already, you know, had a group of folks that we knew. So that helped a lot. That really helped a lot. But the friendships there on campus, that helped me. That helped a great deal.
Got it. It's really interesting that you bring up the bridge program, because we actually have a different version of that for first-gen students who are the first in their families to attend college. I was part of a summer program called FISEP, First Year Summer Enrichment Program, and I definitely relate with being able to make friends beforehand, so that really helped me.
Yeah, it did. Definitely does help.
Yeah. Would you say you were able to find community at Dartmouth, specifically with other Black students?
You don't know.
Can you hear me now?
I lost you. Are you there? Okay, I don't know what happened. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Hello?
Yeah. Yes. Can you hear me? I'm here. Hold on.
Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. Sorry about that. I think the internet on campus is acting up today.
Okay.
I was about to check. Would you say you were able to find community at Dartmouth, but specifically with other Black students?
Definitely. Yes, definitely. And I think about that now because it was my first, like I said, I, you know, grew up in a real small setting, community, close-knit. And so coming to campus was really my first time. I'm trying to think of where I had been prior to coming to Dartmouth. I think, you know, family-wise, we probably, you know, my dad was into camping, so he threw us all into Volkswagen van, whatever they call that thing. And camper is what it was. So we would go Niagara Falls, you know, Canada, see family, but we hadn't really been anywhere. So I had not had the experience of meeting people from other states really. And so that was really, really, that was a really good experience for me, because coming to campus, you know, I met people that were from the East Coast. I met people from the West Coast, people from the South, you know, people from all over. Actually, when I was in the bridge program that summer, I had two roommates. So one roommate was from Brooklyn. And then my other roommate was, Sandra was from Brooklyn. And Lydia was from a reservation in Arizona. So she was Native American. So this was like really opened my eyes. But it was so wonderful because meeting people from all over, they brought with them to campus those things that they had enjoyed coming up, you know, from their culture, from their neighborhood or whatever. And so when I got to campus, there were a couple of classmates, particularly from the Philly area, that introduced me to African dance. And that was one of the things, because I did love to dance. You know, I wasn't, you know, a star dancer, but I did love to dance. And I thought that was so wonderful. So we would get together sometimes and put this music on, and some of the guys would drum. And, you know, it was just amazing, you know, and I love that. And then one of my friends, Viola, was from New Jersey. And she was the only person other than me that I knew that came to campus with a sewing machine. So I had a little tiny sewing machine, this little thing that my sister-in-law had given me, she didn't want. And Viola came to campus with a sewing machine. So, you know, it was just, it was really, really good. I don't know that I would have made it had it not been for the friendships that were formed on campus.
That's true. Thank you for sharing that. Did you have any Black professors or faculty members whom you confided in during your undergrad career?
Not really. Not professors. There were some people on staff that, you know, sometimes would invite us to their house off campus, you know, have cook for us, have dinner and stuff like that. But in terms of confining in, no, I didn't feel like I had. I mean, I know my experience is different from a lot of other people, but I just didn't. And you have to remember, too, I was really a shy kid.
Yeah,
I was really shy. And so, yeah, I didn't. Actually, I did not have, I'm trying to think. There were very few Black professors that I encountered on campus, period. So, yeah.
That makes sense. Were you aware that the college accepted more Black students than ever in the late 1960s compared to the past decades?
I don't think I found that out. Well, they might probably told us that, but I think it really sunk in more so down the road, that I realized that, which is interesting. I find it to be very, very interesting. And I've looked back through some of the history, so I understand what was going on that made those numbers high at that point. But yes, no, I can't say for sure that that was, you know, in the forefront of my mind while I was there.
How did that information impact how you entered the college as someone who faces a double jeopardy between gender and race?
I will say it was interesting, I'll say, because it was the first time that I had been out, you know, coming up in this environment that was like all Black. Even though in early years when we lived in Cincinnati, the schools were integrated there. But when, as soon as we moved to Dayton, Dayton has a long history of segregation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Black folks lived on West Side, white people lived on East Side, and that's where you lived. And that's, you know, consequently, it was a close community, even outside of, I'm saying Dayton proper, not even the township, because it was even smaller, tighter, closer community there. But coming to campus, it was the opposite of what I knew. And so now I'm in an environment, I hadn't really thought all that through when I made my decision, you know? I just knew I was getting away and I was going far away. That fit the bill for me. And I knew they had art. So I was, you know, I was like, okay. But yeah, it was very different. You know, when you come up in a close-knit community, for me, from, you know, since I was born, with Kentucky, it was close-knit. It was a small town. Dayton, close-knit, segregated. And then coming to campus, there were a lot of adjustments that had to be made. You know, I was used to people being friendly,
right,
and speaking to one another.
Yes.
And that wasn't the case. It was like, oh my, where am I? So yeah, that was one of the first things I noticed. I'm like, wow, you say hello and people just keep going.
Walking. Yeah.
I don't see you. I was like, wow.
Thanks so much.
Where am I? So that was an adjustment. And then, you know, the climate, what was going on. So when, prior to me coming to campus, you know, things that I saw in elementary, my dad was very active locally in terms of protesting for employment. He would also make signs, you know, the protest signs for rent strikes or whatever. Yeah, I would watch my dad paint those. He had the just beautiful, beautiful lettering skills, you know, graphic. I don't know where he got all this from, but yeah, I could see that red paint just as clear as day. And I'm watching him paint these signs. And so there were, you know, things, there were some riots that went on in Dayton before I got to college. There were, you know, I saw hoses turned on my dad, you know, on TV. And I was like, oh, there's dad, you know, as they were protesting. And that was for employment at one of the department stores that refused to hire Blacks to work at the counters, like the makeup counters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so all of that was part of my tapestry, so to speak. And so coming to campus, it was an adjustment. But I was thankful for those friendships that were formed that summer in Bridge, because those were the people that I would remain close to for the duration of those 4 years, pretty much. Not all of them, but there were enough to keep me, you know, sane, so to speak.
Yeah.
And have some kind of social interaction.
I'm so happy to hear that you're able to have a supportive group of friends. That's really important, especially going into an environment that's foreign to you.
Yes. Yes.
On a sort of different note, in 1973, Roe v. Wade was passed by the Supreme Court, and I was wondering whether this decision was a big deal on campus, and if you remember the college's reaction, if they had any.
Yeah, I looked at that. In those questions you sent me, and I was like, I cannot honestly say that I remember. I know we're the screen's freezing up. Okay. Could you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah.
Oh, when it freezes, can you hear me?
No.
Oh, okay. What I was saying was, I don't honestly remember the reaction on campus. There were a lot of things going on campus during that time when I was there. And I can remember there being some, what you would call, activists coming. I remember Flo Kennedy coming to campus. And I'm thinking, whoa, they invited her here, you know, because she was all about Black power. And she was kind of tough. And you know, she didn't hold wince, you know, she didn't hold her or mince her words. And, you know, I can remember people coming to campus. But in terms of that impact, I can't say honestly that I recall anything with it. That was just me. You know, I was kind of in survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let me get through this place. And right. So, no. Yes.
Got it. Thank you for sharing. Now we will transition back to your passion for the arts. May you tell me more about the art program at Dartmouth?
In terms of what it was like?
Yes.
I thought it was very difficult in the sense that it was difficult to get into the program. And I had no idea it was going to be like that. I thought you just went off to college. I would go up there to campus and just say, declare, I'm going to be an art major. Because initially, when I came to campus, I actually thought I was going to be an anthropologist. I had changed my mind again, Jackie. And so, because I loved just learning about different people and cultures. And I took that first class, unfortunately, freshman year. Didn't have good advisement on that. And I got that book that looked like it was about 6 inches thick. That's an exaggeration, but I'm just saying it was thick.
Yeah.
And I opened it and went to, I think, one or two classes. And I was like, oh, okay, this is not going to work for me. So I think I dropped it within the first couple of weeks. Right. Like, you didn't stick with what you know. So in terms of the art department, I don't think I got in until, you didn't start until, I want to say sophomore year. Can we pause for a minute?
Yeah.
Can I step away? I need to go get up.
Yeah, yeah, drop. Of course. Yes, of course.
I'll be right back. Sorry.
No worries.
All right. Sorry.
No worries. No need to apologize.
Ooh, not the rope. All right. Hopefully this haul will hold me over.
From the documentary, you noted how a professor humiliated you in front of the class. If you could speak to the professor, what would you tell them?
Look at me now. Probably, I've thought about that through the years, and depending on what year it was, I've had a different response, I'll say. Actually, this morning it was passing through my mind,
really?
And I was just thinking, you know, I think about the role of a teacher,
yes,
the role of an educator, and you know, it simply came to me this morning, you know, that role is to teach,
right.
To encourage, at least that's my definition of it. And, you know, I've had been blessed to work with a lot of youth since for the last probably almost 25 years. And I think about, I think about the damage I would have done if I ever had allowed words, those kind of words to come from my mouth towards a student. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of me wants to say shame on you.
Right.
No.
Sure.
So no, I don't really have that much to say to that. I wouldn't have that much to say. Other than look at me and shame on you.
Right.
You know, that's a big thing.
Yeah, that's understandable. What did you do during the few years you left art following that situation?
I agonized over it. I can't lie about that. It was painful. It was mm-hmm. painful for me because it was something that, you know, this was just who I was. And it was... art had always been something that brought me a lot of joy.
Yeah.
And it made me temporarily, I'll say, even though it was a long length of time I stepped away, mm-hmm. You know, doubt my ability. And I think had I had someone to connect to
right.
on campus, someone that I felt I could confide in, that it would have been maybe a little different. But regardless, like I say, you know, The journey's been magnificent. Yes, there have been some painful parts of it, but I would not, if I had to do it again, I would probably do it the same. I don't know that I would change anything. Because I feel like despite what happened that day, that really made me feel like I will never do this again, it actually was strengthening me. And so even though that person, you know, for whatever reason, I still this day, I'm not even, I don't know what makes people do things like, I don't know. I don't get it. But I feel like it just made me, that it did not totally extinguish my flame.
Right.
And so there was enough still burning inside of me. Because like I said, that period of time that I stepped away from the art, was, you know, I was in anguish because it's like you're trying to step away from yourself.
Yes.
And that's so difficult. I always told, you know, I never really talked about it. And the little bit that I would share with very few people, you know, I always said it was my period of self-exile.
Yeah.
And so it gave me time to think. But during that time, I was still seeking it out, even though I said I didn't want to do it anymore. So even in the workplace, you know, that's where I looked for anything that was creative, anything that I could just grab onto something that was creative. I would do that. But I do see it as a time of strengthening for me, personal strengthening, because once I came through that period of time, you know, I knew what I had to do. I knew what I had to do, and that was to be true to myself and true to my family. So I just went for it. So bit by bit, it wasn't like I just, you know, dived in, but I just started positioning myself and so that I could work myself back into that and put myself in position where I could be around the arts. That was how I addressed it. But yeah, that period of time sharpened me.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing. How did your parents react when you told them that you were abandoning art for a period of time?
Didn't tell them. No one knew. Mm-mm. I swallowed that. That went down inside of me so deep. I did not tell anyone. I swallowed it. I said, I won't do it. And I left that campus after graduation. And so, no, I did not. So when the piece that you're referencing that was done locally here by the PBS station.
Yeah.
When I shared that, that was the first time I told that story. I had never told. I told my children a part of that story and when they were younger. And it's only because they walked in when I was looking through my college portfolio. I still have that. I still have it. They didn't even know that I drew. They didn't know. My husband didn't even know. So I was holding that in. I held it.
I held it. A long time. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So when my mom, my dad had passed, he passed shortly after I had graduated from college. And so my mom was able to see when I first started my first solo exhibition, she came. She became one of my biggest cheerleaders. And yeah, and I was thankful. I was thankful for her being able to see that.
Right.
And she just, yeah, she championed me on, you know, through the years. Yeah. She just loved everything that I did. Yeah. Yes. And the fact that I took the time one day to teach her how to draw a cup, which she told everyone because she said, I don't know how to draw. I can't do it. And I said, yes, you can, Mom. And I just, you know, showed her how to draw a cup. And she thought that was the greatest thing ever.
I'm so glad that your mom had a change of heart at the end.
Yes.
That's so nice.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. What do you wish Dartmouth provided you during your undergrad career that may have prevented you from leaving art?
I think mentorship.
Yes.
You know, a mentoring program. Something particularly, you know, if ideally, looking at the students coming into that department, like I said, I came from a school system that didn't have anything, you know, in terms of art department. So it wasn't like, you know, I knew the latest and all that. I didn't get that kind of instruction that some of the students in, you know, my classmates got in that department. Right. I didn't have that. Actually, I remember my senior year, Ashley Bryan was on campus in the art department. And I remember him, I had one class, I think, with him. He was the first Black professor in the art department that I saw while I was there. So he came in the end of my college time there. He saw something that I had drawn one day, and he said something to me at the end of class. He said, has no one ever taught you perspective? And I said, no. And he just said, come here. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, told me to come into his office. He said, do you mind if I draw on your sketch pad? And I was like, no. And he just took the time right then and there to show me perspective. This was 4 years into my degree. Yeah. I'm an art major. And no one had ever taken the time, you know. So I felt like no one really was looking at what I was doing. I was there. You know, affirmative action was big when I came in. And I felt oftentimes that I was there just as a number, so to speak, as a stat. But in terms of someone being invested in me as a student, it would have been nice to have someone in that department who I felt was invested in me. There were professors I had that I loved in the art history department, and even in the visual arts. You know, I had a couple professors but in terms of having someone to really take the time and invest in me as a student, I wish that had been there. Right. I wish there had been something. You know, I'm imagining other programs, maybe other departments have some, I don't know. But I would have loved to have had something there, mentoring, some type of mentoring in that department to help me to understand, you know, because there was a lot I didn't understand. I didn't understand the process. I didn't understand this whole thing of creating art and everybody's doing the same thing.
Right.
That didn't make sense to me because I had never had any formal instruction. Right. So I kind of railed against it when I was in there. But having someone explain that to me, that would have helped too.
That's true. Yeah. How did you navigate imposter syndrome when you faced it?
Can you repeat that? How did I what?
Yeah. How did you navigate imposter syndrome when you faced it on campus?
What was the, because you're kind of breaking up.
Oh, how did you navigate imposter syndrome when you faced it?
You said imposter?
Yeah, imposter syndrome. Yeah.
Imposter syndrome. I'm not sure if I know what that is. Imposter syndrome.
It's pretty much when someone doubts like their skills or talents because they're sort of comparing themselves to those around them and they feel as though they're an imposter, not really living up to those expectations.
Okay. All right. This is one I should have had beforehand. I should have looked at this one. Okay. Okay. So repeat that question one more time.
Yeah. How did you navigate imposter syndrome when you faced it? How were you able to go through that, overcome it?
I think I'm understanding what you're asking me. I've never heard that before.
Got it.
That was new to me. That's a new term. Imposter syndrome. In terms of how it applied to myself, you're throwing me off, Jackie. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah. So in terms of how that applied to myself, explain that a little bit more. This is confusing me.
Yeah, sorry. So I can give an example. So I know a lot of my friends who are in STEM, they feel as though they're not as intelligent as the other students, and sometimes they doubt their own ability. They question why they got into Dartmouth, how they got into Dartmouth, and then they sometimes also feel, even though like affirmative action is no longer used, they sort of feel like they're just a number here, and that they're not really contributing much.
Okay. Okay, I think I understand you. Okay, sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
I've always felt like, I guess I was confused. I can remember talking to the department head while I was there, because you would have to, I remember going in for my senior project. I had to go a couple of times because what I was proposing, I remember him telling me it wasn't art, it was craft. And I thought that was ludicrous. I thought he was just nuts. I really did. And it was frustrating to me, because I realized that here I am thinking I'm coming here to get this wonderful arts education. And I did. So don't take me wrong. But it was like the hurdles that you had to, you know, overcome, all the stuff you had to jump, you know, the hoops you had to jump through. I thought that was unnecessary because it made me feel like definitely you're not, you know, it's just a very singular mindset. Like right. There was only one way to do this and there was no room for anything else. And it was a very narrow, for me, the way I saw it, it was very narrow in terms of how the art, you know, how art was viewed in that department.
Yeah.
And so here I am, this kid who, like I said, no formal training. I'm just all about creativity. I love the arts, da, 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 da. You know, loved all my art history classes for the most part. Learned a lot, the exposure and stuff. And I just wanted, you know, create and do all this, but I felt like I was being squished, you know, nope, you can't expand out like that. You need to stay right in this little narrow section right here. And that was stifling. It was stifling. I've heard a few people, when I came out of college and spoke to other people that had gone to other colleges in terms of art majors, speaking about similar experiences, but they had been advised, there was someone there that pulled them aside that said, look, do what they're asking you to do. And then when you get out of here, you can do whatever you want with your work, but just follow, you know, play the game, so to speak, play the game, go along with them. And even one of my friends who had this experience when she was in college, not at the same college, but somewhere else, but she was telling me how she would be painting like her color palette, like she had to change it to meet the standards of the college. Mm-hmm. And so she would paint the way she wanted to paint. But then when it came time for the professor to come around and do the critiques, she would turn that painting over and pull out this other one that had the palette that they were asking for. And that's, you know, I didn't get that, yeah, you know, memo. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy. Nuts. And so I don't know, you know, like I said, I struggled with it. I pushed against it. It didn't get me anywhere. It really didn't. You know, I didn't change anything. At the end of the day, it was like, do what they want. But it felt like it was taken away from me, like who I was. And, you know, having to fake something, you know, do something. And it's probably standard. It was probably standard, I'm guessing, for art departments across the country.
Yeah.
But that vision of art was not inclusive. It was very white. You know, there was no room for what I saw as being art. I felt like there was no room for it. So I don't know if that answered your question, Jackie.
Yes, it did. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Now transitioning to your current work in College Views, mm-hmm. what is your current line of work? with art?
My currently I'm textiles, working in textiles, loving it. I had I started out with collage, doing collage, so working exclusively with papers. And then some years ago, started adding some fabric, and over time, just, you know, travel impacted. I had a was able to do an exchange to Tanzania 12 years ago. And so I went and stayed, a month or so, I think. Maybe it was longer than that, but it was a month, I think. And that was a really opened my eyes and really changed, I guess, the trajectory of my work when I came back. I didn't realize it, but it just started, it's changed. So from there, I had already started working with fabric and working it into my collage. But when I came back, I was so fascinated by the fabric that I saw the women wearing. Mm-hmm. And so I came back and I was still doing, you know, painting my papers, really making these designs. So I went, eventually I just turned to fabric and pulled my sewing machine out. I had a brand new sewing machine I had purchased from my art sales, a treat to myself, and I wasn't using it. And so I took it out and I made this piece that I call Freedom. And it just opened a door for me. So I still approach my textile work as if it's collage, because to me it still is. I am not a traditional quilter, even though I quilt the pieces that I create, but I'm still collage, you know? So I just have new materials, and I have the sewing machine, and that's an additional tool for me. I use it like a drawing tool. It's a large drawing tool, but I use it as a drawing tool, and that's how I see it. And I love it. The journey has been fantastic. It's been an incredible journey. And that's, you know, that's kind of what I'm doing now.
Got it. So, Thank you. How do you believe Dartmouth prepared you for your current career?
I think it definitely instilled in me the importance of perseverance.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, had I allowed one person to extinguish my flame, so to speak, I think about it, you know, I find myself thinking about it a lot, because I think about all the young people I've worked with through the years that I would not have had an opportunity to work with. I think about where this art journey has taken me. I think of the different places I have had been blessed to show my work. I think about even the experience of the exchange, the artist exchange, and that was a women's artist exchange to Tanzania. You know, that was through the U.S. State Department. And I think about that and all the incredible women artists I met, all the experiences I've had. And I wouldn't have had those if I did not get that whole piece about perseverance. So despite what happened, even that was one person, you know, there was so much more that I got from campus. You know, spending time in the costume department over in the theater department, that is definitely something that is a foundation of my textile work. Because pattern making, you know, I do a lot of pattern making for my current work. And it's not that I'm building costumes or clothing for that matter, but I use patterns on pieces that I know I like those shapes and I want to be able to do that shape again. I will make a pattern. But that started for me in that costume department, being in there and seeing, learning how to create and construct patterns. So, you know, there, the love of, you know, my work has a lot of, I do a lot with African mask, the love of African art. I got that from Dartmouth. You know, the professors, one of my professors had done a lot of Peace Corps work and would share his little 8mm films. and they were breathtaking. You know, I'm looking at these people from across the globe and dancers and all kinds of things. And it's like, it was just incredible. And so, yes, that I think the love of art was strengthened. I think the love of people was strengthened in cultures. I think the love of people and the acceptance of others was strengthened despite what I encountered. Yeah. But I was able to meet people from all over the world while on campus. And that just also just kind of lit my fire for travel, you know, travel. And that's a, you know, important to me as an artist, that I get out, see other places and things yeah. like that. So definitely the perseverance, I took that away, you know, just stick to it, whatever it is that is your passion, you've got to persevere no matter what, because that was one experience. And believe me, I encountered more after that as an mm-hmm. artist, once I started putting my work out there professionally. And you just have to stick to it. And it's one of the things that I share with young people, you know, that you can't let people define you. You can't let someone else tell you who you are, because they haven't a clue. Exactly. They really don't. Unless they spent time with you, mm-hmm. in-depth time, they don't know you.
That's true.
So that professor, you know, way back my junior year, whatever it was, she didn't know me. She really didn't. She was a visiting professor, you know, from another country. She wow. did not know me. So yes, you just, you know, that's what I took away. So it's allowed me to, I say, be an encourager to others, mm-hmm. adults and youth, through the years. And I feel like that has been my mission for so long because of my experience. So it has made me definitely an advocate. Like, if you're interested in the arts, hey, go for it. I'm always here for you. You can call me. I'm a resource, on and on. So that's what I got. You know, that's what it's enabled me to do. Yeah.
Got it. Thank you so much for sharing and for being someone who has become a role model for others to prevent situations like that from happening to anyone else. What are your current views on the college and the active Black community on campus surrounding the Shabazz Center for Intellectual Inquiry and Delta Sigma Theta, a historically African-American sorority, now?
Excuse me. I'm going to need you to catch me up, because I don't know if you're aware, I just came back to campus in May for the first time after graduating.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yes. Yes. Okay. You didn't know that, did you, Jackie?
No.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. I just came back.
Wow.
So that's how I felt when I left. I'm gone.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So, but I mean, when I came back, I'll speak to how I felt when I came back. How about that?
Yes.
When I came back, the only reason I came back was because I was, one of my classmates reached out to me. Mm-hmm. And when I left campus, I unfortunately lost contact with just about everyone that I had known. And even when mm-hmm. I wanted to reach out to people, I didn't know, you know, I didn't have at that point numbers and all that kind of stuff. So I just lost contact, and probably just one or two people that I knew how to reach and wouldn't talk with them often. But classmate reached out, and she was one of three females, Black females, that were in the art department with me when I was on campus. And she gave me a heads up. She said, you know, someone's going to contact you. So make a long story short, I was commissioned by BATA to create a piece to pay tribute to the women who had graduated between, all of this is going out of my mind now. It's like, between 70, what was it? Between 72 and 76. So there were 37 African-American women who graduated. And some of them included those that were transfers. from sister the sister schools. And so I was working on this world. It happened, I think I was approached in the spring, earlier in the year. Anyhow, along the way, about the second week that we were meeting online, the question came up. And the question was, well, does this mean that you're coming back to campus? Because the two people that I was working with on this, Eileen Cave, who was my classmate, mm-hmm. and Woody Lee, from the class of 68, they both knew that I had not been back to campus since I graduated. So the question was, are you coming? And when the question was raised, I felt a flutter like in my stomach, and it wasn't like a good flutter. I'm like, uh-oh. You know, I thought I was just going to create a piece and ship it off, and that was it. Hadn't thought about coming to campus. That was not on my radar. Wasn't thinking about it. Wasn't planning to. And I said, you know, I'm a praying woman, so let me pray about that. I'll get back to you. So it was probably 2 weeks later. The question came again, and I said, you know what? I am coming back, because I realized there were some loose ends. I thought I was good. There were some things that I needed. I needed to tie up, so to speak. So I came back in May. This past May was the first time I came back. So if you can imagine, I'd been gone, 45 years or so, coming back, and everything looks different. You know, the green was still there. Mm-hmm. I could identify the library. Few things right there in the center of campus, but so much had changed. And so when I came back, I needed to come back.
Right.
I needed to come back. And I was really welcomed. I felt really welcomed coming back. I had no idea. I didn't know how I would feel. I didn't know what it was going to do coming back. I had spoken to someone, another classmate, and she had shared her experience when she first went back. She had had some experiences while she was there. Everybody has a story. And so I didn't know what to expect, but it was really, really good. It was definitely something I needed to do for many reasons, for myself to have some closure. And I thought I had closure on that particular part of my life. But it also, Jackie, gave me such a sense of responsibility to the students who are currently on campus. And that was the part that I felt like, oh my goodness, you know, I have been missing that. And I do have a responsibility to do something for, I don't know exactly what yet, but I did leave with that urgency, wanting things to be better for the students who are there, particularly students of color.
Yes.
And so, yes. When I came back, the piece was presented, and I got to share a little bit of story because nobody knew. Like I said, I kept it to myself.
Right.
I did not, unfortunately, get over to, we called it the AM when I was there, the mm-hmm. Afro AM.
Yeah, now the Shabazz.
Well, it changed. Yeah, it changed like right towards the end of that 4 years. It changed. The name changed. And it was going through some changes when I was there, you know, because there was a little bit of push to have it open to women to live there, because it had been all male.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was, because I'm thinking to myself, who wants to live over here with all these guys? I mean, that was my thought. I don't know. And I know there were a couple women did move in while I was there, which I thought was interesting. And so, yeah, I'm not sure how it functions now. When I was there though, Jackie, that was where we got, everything took place there.
Yeah.
That was our hub. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, I mean, sometimes there were speakers that came there.
Yeah.
Sometimes there were meetings just keeping us abreast on what was happening on campus. particularly my junior year, because that the piece that I created honoring, paying tribute to those 37 women, I had to figure out and sift through all this information, like, what am I going to focus on? And what I did was to, in honoring those 37, I also brought to light in that piece the three women from my class who were responsible for the report on institutional racism at Dartmouth. And so I was able to say thank you to them, because it caused me, when I was researching for that piece, what struck me was the fact, you know, I knew all this was going on when I was there. You know, we were all made well, you know, kept abreast of what was going on. We protested, you know, we had sit-ins, we were on the steps and all that, administration building. But it didn't sink in as much as it did until I started working on that piece. And I saw it from a different end of the lens, so to speak. Because now, being older, and I'm looking back, and I realize what a monumental piece these three took on. There were more that worked on it with them, but when it came to the end of the day, my understanding is no one else wanted to sign off on it but those three women. And so I thought about it, and I had conversation, because Eileen Cave was one of the people I spoke with about it. And I told her, I said, my goodness, you know, we were kids. We were kids when this was going on. And taking on adult issues, well, they were our issues too, because we were students there. But I'm saying, taking it on in a sense of challenging the administration, who were adults. Definitely adults, long time adults. It was big. That was a big thing to do. It was super courageous, especially when you see people backing out at the end and like, no, I don't want to sign off on this. And I just, you know, it was like, wow. Here you were on campus as young women trying to make a difference for all of us and bringing it, you know. They weren't the only ones, but I'm saying they had the courage, the balls, whatever you want to say, you know, to actually take it there, you know, and make sure it was seen, even though nothing came of it. You know, it was like, there's nothing going on. It was swept under the rug, so to speak. But still, the fact that it was done, to me, that was major. That was major, major, major. Particularly when you look at the history of college campuses, other Ivy League schools, what was going on during that time. And we were very isolated. So, you know, we were like in a little, I don't know what you want to call it, whereas other campuses were, you know, had the support of a city. Yeah. We didn't have that. We were just completely isolated. Anyhow. Coming back was, I met so many wonderful alum from other classes, and it was really, it struck me as I thought it was kind of funny at first, but then I realized people were serious when they would ask what class you were from, and I would respond, and they were like, oh, you're one of the pioneers. And, you know, I didn't think of it that way. I didn't see it like that coming to campus. I knew it was, had been an all male institution prior to, you know, our class coming in. I knew that much. But it just didn't strike me that way. You know, I didn't realize, you know, the significance of it until much later down the road. But definitely coming back, I do feel such a responsibility to the students there.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like I said, I haven't quite figured out yet how I am going to figure out some way that I will be supportive of those students who are there. Like I said, particularly the students of color in whatever way I can, if nothing more than just an encourager, you know, when times seem rough, hey, I'm here. I'm available. If you need to talk, whatever. But yes, it's necessary. It is necessary. I'm not sure what the story is with the, you mentioned the Deltas, because we didn't have any
Theta.
We didn't have sororities when I was there, you know?
Yeah, that's a historically African-American sorority. So I actually have a friend who's part of that. And she was telling me that it almost is like a secretive society where they are told not to speak because they're just being assessed on whether they should enter the sorority. And pretty much the sorority does community service for the Black community. And they have the common goal of bringing justice for the community. So it's very geared only toward Black students.
Yes, I'm familiar with the Greek organizations, the Black Greek organizations, but I didn't know why you mentioned that particular sorority.
Oh, yes. I was just asking whether you were aware of it, of how active it is right now.
No, because like I said, I'm just reconnecting, mm-hmm. believe it or not. Right. Yes, I read the alum magazines. I read a little bit of that. But really, and you know, one part, you know, I kind of feel like, and I don't feel bad. I was going to say, I kind of feel bad that I don't. It's just been my journey. Okay. Right. Been my journey. I was extreme. I was one of those. And there are others out there. There mm-hmm. are other people that have not been back to campus since they graduated.
Yeah.
But no, I'm just saying I came back. But when I came back, I realized that the responsibility continues. There were those before my arrival on that campus who felt the responsibility that made it possible for us to be there.
Right.
And I just feel that continuation. I feel that responsibility. And so, yes, so I am making plans to reconnect mm-hmm. and find a way that will be viable for me to really help in some form or fashion.
Right. If you'd like, after this interview, I can connect you with a few of my friends who live in Shabazz. I can give you your contact email. And if you want to provide your phone number, I can also give that to them.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, sure. I would love to. Yeah, definitely.
Perfect. Definitely. Thank you. Now, we're almost done with this interview. I have three more questions. I might have follow-up questions, but we're going to transition now to advice you would give your past self and others. So first question, that topic is, what advice would you give undergraduate students, especially those with minoritized backgrounds, if they face a similar situation where a professor undermines their abilities?
I would say, if you're able to, that stay connected to your family, stay connected to, hopefully you have a support, some kind of support somewhere, even if they are not in Hanover. I would say it is important to stay connected. Because there may be times when you just need to be reassured. Are we disconnected?
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're connected again.
They lost you. I don't know if you can hear me or not. Should I keep talking?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I'll keep talking
hear me?
Until you pop back on. Yes. So support is crucial. So whether that's from alum, professors, you just need to be connected. Don't isolate. You're already operating on a campus that is very isolated. So you don't want to further that isolation, so to speak. So it is important. I would definitely advise to connect to someone that has more wisdom than you on that campus. And that might even be an upperclassman. You know, it could be a junior or a senior even. I don't even know if there is such a program that would connect upperclassmen with, incoming freshmen or sophomore. But yeah, definitely you need support and need some type of support.
Got it. Thank you for that. What would you tell students who have a passion for the arts but are concerned about the financial uncertainty it may bring?
All right. I think I lost you.
Oh, can you hear me?
All right.
Can you hear me?
I can now. I don't know. Could you hear me when I was still talking?
I heard your response, yes.
Oh, you did? Okay, because I couldn't see. You were gone completely.
Oh, that's weird. Okay.
And I was like, okay, I don't know if you can hear it. Let me keep going. Yes. Okay, so you heard me say support.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Okay.
What would you tell students who have a passion for the arts but are concerned about the financial uncertainty it may bring?
You know what? What I realized, Jackie, is you have to believe. You have to believe in yourself. Because regardless of what happens on campus, you're going to encounter people out in the world. You know, I don't know what they call them now. Young kids used to call them haters. I don't know what they call them.
Yeah. But,
you know, I mean, they're a dime a dozen. That's the sad thing is they're a dime a dozen. And you're going to encounter people along the way for whatever reason that feel like they need to share with you and really to knock you down. You know, maybe it stems from jealousy. Maybe it stems from what they perceive, you know, a misperception of who you are. What, you know, it could be any number of reasons, but you have to be strong in yourself. You have to, you just have to believe. So if you're passionate about it and it's what you really want to do, you have to just keep going, no matter how bleak it may seem. You know, one of the things, unfortunately, that I still hear younger artists say from time to time is this whole term, and it just makes me cringe, that starving artist. That is the craziest thing. I don't know where it stems from. But I always tell anyone I encounter to rinse that out of your mouth. Do not speak that, because our words are powerful. And if you start saying that, that's embedding itself within, you know, it's within you. That's going to become embedded. It becomes a part of you. And so it's like you have to know this is what, you know, whatever it is, whatever your field is, I'm going to do this. No matter what anyone says, no matter what, how many rejections or whatever, I'm going for it. Because if it's really what brings you joy, it's really what you've been called to do, it doesn't matter. No one can stop you. It's going to get done. It's going to get done. And we all have a different path. No one, there's no two ways to getting to your destination. You know, somebody over there, they may have had a different route, but that whole thing of, that whole starving artist piece, no. I would say definitely connect with those alumni who have come through. And they don't even have to be on campus, anyone. You know, I definitely was, when I came out of, left Dartmouth, and I was trying to figure out, you know, what's my path going to be. I, at one point, just pulled a list of people together and I interviewed them. I called them and asked if they could spare 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes for interview. And I interviewed them so I could learn more about their field, how they function in their field. And that in turn helped me to know if that was the direction I needed to go. Right. So, you know, even for someone who stepped away for 10 years, coming back, I positioned myself. So step by step, you know, I went and I did, you know, something over here. I was a docent at the art museum here for almost 10 years. I did that because that put me closer to art. That put me in a position to know, it turned out, to be with other artists that happened to be volunteering there at the museum as well. It put me in close vicinity to CCAD, which is Columbus College of Art and Design. And I was able to go over there and I ended up going back and taking foundational courses, which was amazing. And so, you know, you just have to do what you have to do. You know, you go for it, you line yourself up, you connect with people along the way. And that's one of the things that I did not do when I was there. I did not connect with the alum. Mm-hmm. That was a major mistake, I'll say. I'm not sure if it would have been, you know, done any more for me, but, you know, as I listened to other classmates, some of them definitely connected. But no, I would just say you just have to believe. You have to believe in yourself, even when no one else does. You got to believe in yourself and be true to yourself and be your authentic self.
Got it. Thank you. That was beautiful. I appreciate that advice. Now, last question. Mm-hmm. If you could speak to your younger self as a child or an undergraduate student, what would you tell her?
As a child, I would say, because I was painfully shy, those people that you are, that scare you, because people kind of frighten me, you know, speaking frightened me. You'll get over it. Okay. It's not going to be, it won't last forever. And actually you will do things in the future to purposely put you in a position to force you to speak to people. And I did that. And so you'll get over that. It won't be a hindrance all your life, and continue to embrace the arts because it's who you are. So definitely don't let anyone tell you any differently, no matter how it looks. You know who you are, so you just keep walking in that. That's what I would say to younger self.
Got it. Thank you so much. That concludes our interview. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be interviewed for my oral history project.
Oh, Jackie, I appreciate you. You know, your questions definitely made me think. And yeah, a couple threw me off. Like, okay. But no, I think it's such a wonderful thing to do. And now, did you come up with the questions, or these were pulled together by the professor, or where'd the questions come from?
I came up with the questions. The only one they gave me were, may you state your full name, your parents' name, and your hometown. But everything else was me.
That's all. Oh my. Okay. Your questions were fantastic. Your questions were wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah,
wonderful. Thank you.
No, you really made me think, you know, really had me thinking there. I was like, okay, maybe I should have prepped a little more, but no, I hopefully you can make sense of what I said.
Yes, for sure. If I have any questions, would you be open to me emailing you just for a few like clarifying questions on your responses?
Yes. Okay. Yes. No problem. Mm-hmm. So what are your, are we off the, is it still recording?
Yeah, I can stop recording, then we can continue speaking if you'd like.
Okay, yeah. Because I just would like to ask you a few questions.